Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly clean homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the home security system many of the most anxious people I know recommend. Here's why people love it. Trusted by experts, Simply Safe was named Best Home Security System for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. And Newsweek awarded it Best Customer Service in Home Security. The system blankets your whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property, day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than a dollar a day, so you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. Simply Safe has given many of our listeners real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new Simply Safe system when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring. Just visit simplysafe.com/coverup. That's simplysafe.com/coverup. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
Campsite Media.
The Bench.
For years, a host of employees at USAMRID faced pressure from the FBI. Midnight searches of the labs, seizure of research materials, constant surveillance.
They came into my office, took my desktop computer, took my laptop computer, took all of my disks, thumb drives, everything. So they just cleaned me out. And so I came back, and here I'm ready to work, and I've got nothing.
It was all pretty frustrating. But they did their best to laugh about it.
And this was something that we would do almost all the time over at our happy hours was which of us were in their top 10 of suspects? And hey, you know, what have I got to do to get on the list kind of thing? And then all the joking stopped completely in that last year, I'd say. It just, because it at that point, it was so crystal clear, you know, they were focusing more and more on Bruce.
From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat. Episode 6, The Closers. It's late 2006, and Rick Lambert, the man who led the Amerithrax squad for the last 4 years, has moved on. Rick's cautious approach had ruffled some feathers, and the case had stalled out as a result. The squad needed a new leader, someone with an old-school, back-to-basics investigative instinct to get things back on track. They found that someone, an agent Vince Lisi, former D.C. Homicide Squad. He wasn't exactly thrilled to be picked.
Look, I was driving a Mercedes S-Class, right? Never having to go into the office. Life was good. Going to headquarters is like jumping into a swimming pool of ice-cold water, right? You lose your breath, you become disoriented, and your first reaction is, get me the hell out of here. It's where fun goes to die.
So why did you take it?
Oh, it wasn't a choice.
Another agent from DC's Homicide Squad was hired alongside Vince, the calmer, more methodical agent Ed Montooth.
First thing Ed did was pound his fist on a table and said, I'm in charge here.
Yeah, I put I'm the chief badge on my chest, and they all laughed. But then the first day was really sit down. Okay, just all cards on the table. What the hell's going on? What do we need to do? And that kind of started it.
It was an unusual decision to have two leaders on a single case. But Vince and Ed had exactly the sort of experience, temperament, and skills the squad needed. After 5 years without any arrests, people were starting to think Amerithrax was going cold. And cold cases were Ed's specialty. As Ed and Vince got up to speed on the investigation, one thing became clear. The vast majority of the agents on the squad thought the investigation should be focused squarely on one man, Dr. Bruce Ivins. Bruce's team at USAMRID had spent the last few years believing that he was helping the FBI, helping them understand the science and complexity of the case. Now, he was their prime suspect.
Welcome to True Spies,
The podcast that takes you deep inside the greatest secret missions of all time.
Suddenly out of the darkness appeared Bin Laden.
You'll meet the people who live life undercover. What do they know? What are their skills? And what would you do in their position?
Vengeance felt good. Seeing these people pay for what they'd done felt righteous.
True Spies from Spyscape Studios, wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It was the RMR 1029 breakthrough that had convinced so many of the Amerithrax agents to focus on Bruce. But they knew they'd need a lot more than that to build a case against him, to put together the numerous bricks in the wall that prosecutors talk about needing to win trials. One thing the agents were focused on was a series of concerning emails Bruce had sent to a couple of close friends over the years. The messages showed a long history of mental health issues that, I think it's fair to say, would have gotten anybody's attention. In one email, Bruce wrote, "Even with the Celexa and the counseling, the depression episodes still come and go. That's unpleasant enough. What's really scary is the paranoia." Bruce said that when he experienced these paranoid episodes, he got a metallic taste in his mouth, and that it felt as if he were a passenger on a ride. But one of the more unsettling things they found was a poem Bruce had written in the style of a nursery rhyme. "I'm a little dream self, short and stout. I'm the other half of Bruce when he lets me out. When I get all steamed up, I don't pout. I push Bruce aside, then I'm free to run about. Hickory dickory dock, Doc Bruce ran up the clock. But something happened in a very strange rhythm. His other self went and exchanged places with him. So now, please guess who is conversing with you? Hickory dickory dock." In July 2000, Bruce wrote in an email to a colleague that a therapist had suggested he had paranoid personality disorder, which terrified him. Bruce knew that his mental health issues could jeopardize his security clearance and prevent him from working with lethal pathogens, which would end his career. In one email, he tried to find some dark humor in the situation, imagining himself on the cover of a tabloid with the headline, "Paranoid Man Works with Deadly Anthrax." When Vince and Ed learned about the emails, they refused to jump to conclusions.
It's like, okay, I think we've established he has some mental health issues.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't mean he mailed the letters.
I hate doing stuff by email because it can be interpreted completely different than how it's said, and you don't know the context of the discussion. So, I mean, yeah, you look at them and you're like, you know, an out-of-body experience. I can taste metal and things like that. You're like, what the hell? But you got to dig into, well, how does that fit in this puzzle? So until you can put those emails in the context of what else you have investigatively, those emails don't mean much to you.
The emails did give the squad a window into Bruce's inner world. It sounded like he was struggling with two sides of his personality. The public side, a professional, respected microbiologist and family man, and the side he hid from the world, a troubled man who wasn't sure what he was capable of. But there was someone who was all too familiar with that Bruce. Just weeks after the anthrax attacks, a microbiologist named Nancy Hagwood wrote to the FBI after they'd put out a call for tips. Hagwood suggested that they look into an old colleague from grad school, Bruce Ivins. She said that for nearly 20 years, Ivins had stalked and harassed her, all because of one small detail from her past. Her college sorority, Kappa Kappa Gamma.
KKG was a personal, you know, issue with
obsession.
Ivins. Obsession.
He asked to go out in college, and she told him no, and she belonged to KKG, and that's where it began.
According to investigators, after this rejection as an undergrad, Bruce became fixated on KKG. He grilled any Kappa he met about the sisterhood and broke into a Kappa house to steal a copy of its secret book of rituals. When Bruce met Haygood in grad school, the fact that she was a Kappa stirred up a mix of obsession and scorn for her. He stole her lab notebook, which is priceless to a microbiology student. Then years after they graduated, he allegedly spray-painted the letters KKG on the fence across from Haygood's house. He even tried to make her look bad by writing a letter to the editor that was published in her name defending sorority hazing practices. It was definitely strange behavior. But Vince and Ed didn't see a connection between Bruce's KKG obsession and the anthrax attacks. Until...
Hey, wait a minute. The KKG was right next to the mailbox.
Let's back up here for a minute. Early on in the investigation, one of the first things the Amerithrax squad did was try to find out exactly where the letters were mailed from. Which mailbox did the killer use? They knew the letters were postmarked in New Jersey, so they swabbed and tested hundreds of mailboxes for anthrax. After nearly a year, one finally tested positive. It was at 10 Nassau Street, a busy corner in downtown Princeton. Investigators had always suspected that the mailbox had some special meaning to the mailer.
What's the significance of this mailbox, right?
And that's what everybody was looking at. It's like, why there?
Then the squad realized the mailbox was less than 200 feet from the business office of Princeton University's KKG chapter at 20 Nassau Street. Maybe this location was meaningful after all, to Bruce. It was a big piece of evidence the FBI could use in building their case against him. Circumstantial evidence, but evidence nonetheless. Still, there was one crucial piece of the story that the squad was missing. Motive. Why would Bruce, one of the most respected anthrax researchers in the country, a man who'd worked for the U.S. military for decades, send out a lethal pathogen and terrorize the whole country?
He was very much involved in development of two new anthrax vaccines that were supposed to eliminate a lot of the side effects of the one that was currently being used.
Bruce's USAMRID colleague, Hank Heine again.
I know he'd been working on it for years until the principal funding agency for all of our work kind of pulled the plug on it. Bruce had always been well-funded, well taken care of, and now he was unfunded.
For the FBI, this became the key to understanding Bruce's possible motive. The funding for Bruce's research was cut in 2001, right before the anthrax letters were sent out. Maybe Bruce wanted to scare Americans, make them feel like anthrax was a national security threat, all to secure continued funding for his research into anthrax vaccines. This was a man who tried to secretly discredit a colleague by publishing a letter to the editor in her name. A man who'd been hiding mental health issues from his employer for years. Mailing anthrax letters to get his research funding restored? That didn't seem like too much of a stretch to Vince and Ed. But it was hard for them to get close to Bruce without tipping their hand.
So his world was very small.
Okay.
Right? And so how do you introduce some stranger into a world that consists of work, church, and that's about it?
Juggling, right?
Juggling. But whether it's for the church or at work, I mean, again, his world was so small.
So they decided it was time to pull a little trickery of their own.
We had an undercover operation we ran at him.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
In the 1970s, John Todd burst onto the evangelical scene with a shocking tale. He claimed to be a former witch, involved in a then unheard of secret organization called the Illuminati, and urged Christians to prepare for a violent world takeover.
First of all, the number one weapon in everybody's home should be a 12-gauge pump shotgun.
Hear the amazing story of one of the originators of the modern-day conspiracy theory. From Magnificent Noise and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Cover Up, the Conspiracy Tapes.
In order to discreetly infiltrate Bruce's small world, Vince and Ed had to think outside the box.
We actually learned that he was going on a cruise with his brother. And so the creative juices started flowing. And, you know, one of his big issues was pro-life. So we got two female FBI agents, one of which was very noticeably pregnant, put them on the cruise with a couple other agents as a cover team, right? And we arranged for them to sit at dinner with him one night. And that's all it took. You know, her story was My boyfriend got me pregnant. He wants me to have an abortion. I'm not. I'm going to raise the baby myself, and this is our last big trip before I settle down to raise my child. And
they couldn't get away from him.
Yeah.
He followed them all around the boat.
What were you trying to get out of him with that?
Have somebody establish a relationship and see what didn't we know about him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When Bruce got back from the cruise, he couldn't wait to tell Hank Heine about the two young women who'd been so taken with him throughout the trip. He was now emailing with them on a regular basis.
I said, okay, Bruce, come on, you know, think about it. They're hanging around with you all the time, watching you, you know, everything on the cruise ship and everything. Look, you're no spring chicken, buddy. You know, they were FBI agents. No, they couldn't be.
So Bruce did some detective work. He embedded an invisible watermark in his emails that would tell him the IP address of the computer.
Every time that email was opened, right? And so it was a covert IP address that came back to like ABC Tomato Company or something, right? But he got it, and the address was 7799 Leesburg Pike, Vienna, Virginia. So Bruce, we believe, Googled 7799 Leesburg Pike, Vienna, Virginia, and learned the FBI was located in that building.
Hank was right. The women were undercover agents, and the FBI was monitoring all of Bruce's conversations with them.
But then he threw us a curveball. He starts sending emails talking about his one coworker who has an underground production facility and how his coworker benefited tremendously from the anthrax attacks.
For the FBI, this was more evidence of Bruce's manipulative nature. Rather than confronting the agents or cutting off contact, Bruce was trying to use the situation to his advantage by pointing the finger at a colleague. Or maybe it was another of Bruce's famous pranks. Either way, Vince and Ed were not amused.
Our sights are on him, and there's no backing up.
Right.
And we kind of hit this point where we'd basically done everything we could have done. You know, I mean, we looked through all the emails. We tried to verify alibis. We had a chart on the wall of all his medication. It was like 20 feet long.
All their digging had gotten them a ton of useful circumstantial evidence. They felt confident Bruce was capable of producing the anthrax used in the attacks. They believed the morphs in RMR 1029 clearly established Bruce's flask as its source. And they had what they found to be a credible motive, restoring funding for his research. What they didn't have was physical evidence, something directly linking Bruce to the attacks.
And the team was like, it's time.
On November 1st, 2007, the FBI executed a search warrant on Bruce's house, which was literally across the street from USAMRID. From his front yard, you could see the 12-foot barbed wire fence that surrounds the 1,200-acre complex. The squad had learned their lesson from the Stephen Hatfill fiasco. This time, they went out of their way to keep the search low-key and avoid another media circus.
We waited until dark so we wouldn't draw attention.
Yeah.
Right. They put blackout cloth on the inside of the windows of the house so that people wouldn't see. But we went all night long.
We approached his children and his wife, and we had teams interviewing them all simultaneously at different areas.
And they would give periodic updates, what they found, what they didn't find.
What did they find?
I think the only real things of significance, they showed that he's a prolific letter writer to like the media and to Congress.
They found more than 50 letters to Congress from Bruce. This seemed like another thing that lined up with the profile of the anthrax killer, someone who had a habit of sending mail to powerful people. Bruce once even sent a letter pitching an idea for a TV series to NBC headquarters at 30 Rockefeller Center. One of the anthrax letters was sent to exactly the same address. But this was still circumstantial, not enough to nail Bruce.
So again, look who the letters went to, right? The media and Congress. But no souvenirs, right? No silver bullet. Nobody was doing the happy dance after the search.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. Anthrax spores are notoriously difficult to clean up, even for experts. So if there had ever been any anthrax in Bruce's home or car, it was completely plausible for investigators to find remnants of it even 7 years later. And if they did find a single spore, it would have been proof positive that Bruce had taken anthrax out of the lab. But they found nothing. The search was a dud, and the squad still had no physical evidence. Until the next night, when the surveillance team parked outside Bruce's house saw something strange.
So the very first night of trash after the search warrant was executed, they're out there again. Bruce comes out in like his long johns or something, puts a floodlight on the front of his house to shine on the sidewalk, pulls the trash out. He's overlooking in the bushes for anybody. And he was like feet away from an agent who's standing there paralyzed, like, please don't see me, you know? And then he goes back in the house and he watches, and the trash truck comes and takes the trash. Bruce comes out again. He looks in his trash. He goes down. He looks in his neighbor's trash to make sure it really was a trash truck. He's looking around. Then he takes their trash can back to the house, turns the lights off. And we're like, what the hell is that all about? So in the trash, they find copies of emails that he had with the undercovers, the scientific publication called The Linguistics of DNA, and a book, this thick book called Goederedder Bosch or something like that.
We couldn't read it. If you want to go to sleep, you read it. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it's for smart people.
Yeah.
The book is called Goederedder Bosch by Douglas Hofstetter. It's massive, more than 800 pages, and it's full of science and philosophy about the human mind and consciousness. A major theme of the book is cryptography and codes, which made the FBI take another look back at the text in the anthrax letters for any possible hidden messages.
There are certain letters that are printed that are bolded, right? So there's however many letters, T's and A's and C's and T's that are bolded.
Yeah.
And somebody early on in the investigation said, why are these letters bolded? And then they look and they just write all the letters out and they go, oh, it's a codon sequence. I'm like, what the hell is a codon sequence?
Okay, so to keep it simple, think about DNA as a string of letters. Each clump of three letters is called a codon. And the specific combination of letters in a codon is responsible for creating certain amino acids. For example, TTT represents
phenylalanine, right? And we're like, okay, phenylalanine. He goes, and the next three letters are AAT. AAT is asparagine. And the last three letters are TAT, which is tyrosine, right?
But when scientists refer to those amino acids, they don't use their full names. They just use a single letter for each one, like F for phenylalanine or N for aspergine.
And the same with tyrosine. It's Y.
So what does that spell?
FNY.
Fuck New York?
Right? And they're like, well, you know, Bruce didn't like New York.
And right? He didn't like the Yankees.
Back in the 60s, Bruce had taken a trip to New York for a microbiology conference. He stopped at a restaurant for lunch, and when the waitress rudely threw his spinach salad down on the table, she apparently left Bruce with a lifelong disdain for the city. But let's be honest, this sounds like a long shot.
We brief Mueller on it, and he's like, really? That's what you got from me? Fuck New York. And we're like, no, you got to listen to it. Because when you look at that book, right, it shows bolding letters with codon sequences to send hidden messages.
Yeah.
As 2007 came to an end, Vince and Ed realized they still didn't have what they needed to charge Bruce Ivins, much less close the case. If they wanted to push this thing forward, they needed to talk to Bruce directly.
And the strategy was start off easy, ask him questions that are awkward to answer, but not really about the mailing. It was Ed, the two prosecutors, Ken and Rachel, and me.
He was a talker. It was the most fascinating interview in my 15 years of prosecution.
Former assistant U.S. attorney Rachel Carlson Lieber was a new member of the Amerithrax team, sent over by the Department of Justice to help the FBI build a case that would stand up in court. She was the only woman in the room when they interviewed Bruce.
We did have an over-under on when he would ask if I was a Kappa. And it was under 5 minutes, I think.
He asked. He really did.
Yes. It was like one of those things where you're just like, oh, man.
Now that Bruce's KKG obsession was on the table, Vince and Ed picked it up and ran with it.
First question was, hey, can you tell us about your interest in KKG? Right? And he's like, oh, it's not an interest, it's an obsession. And he's like, there's no logical or rational reason to explain my actions when it comes to KKG. And we said, well, tell us about it, Bruce. So he tells us about how he would burglarize a sorority house, leave at night and come back in the morning, and his wife wouldn't know about it. how he went to the Library of Congress and pulled all of the phone books off the shelves for the East Coast, and he maintained his own, like, manual database. And we asked him, like, hey, what about, like, your KKG things that you stole? Where are they? We didn't see them in the house during the search. And he said, well, when I turned 60, I threw them all away. Right? Why, Bruce? Well, because I was worried I'd have a heart attack and they would find them and I'd be embarrassed.
I would imagine that's almost like unburdening. Like, or did he seem kind of relieved to be able to?
I don't know. He's pretty forthcoming. I was surprised.
I was surprised too.
I just remember thinking, he's talking about breaking into a sorority house as if it's like, and then I went to 7-Eleven and I got a Slurpee. And then I did, right? It was just this like, wow. And I just remember watching Vince, who was like acting as if like, who among us hasn't broken into a sorority house and stolen the cipher and crept away under a cover of darkness, right? Like, yeah, it was this sort of this natural conversation. And I remember just watching it thinking, this is amazing, but also incredibly fruitful.
The Amerithrax team was excited. This was just Vince and Ed's first interview, and Bruce had been stunningly open with them. It confirmed that not only was Bruce as obsessed with KKG as they thought, but also that he sometimes took long drives at night without his wife knowing. That part was especially important, because Bruce's house wasn't very close to 10 Nassau Street in Princeton, New Jersey. In fact, it was over 3 hours away. Now, Vince and Ed could establish that Bruce could have made the drive to that mailbox, all while remaining undetected. They finally felt like they were getting somewhere.
And finally, his attorney said, hey, you know what? It's getting late. Bruce, we're going to have to get out of here.
By the end of the interview, it was unequivocally clear to scientist Bruce Ivins that he was in the FBI's crosshairs. Next time on Cover Up, the anthrax threat.
The FBI came in and escorted him out of the building and took him away. He was not allowed to ever come back. And that was like the beginning of the end.
Unlock all episodes of Cover Up the Anthrax Threat ad-free right now by subscribing to the Binge podcast channel. Not only will you immediately unlock all episodes of the show, but you'll get binge access to an entire network of other great true crime and investigative podcasts, all ad-free. Plus, on the first of every month, subscribers get a binge drop of a brand new series. That's all episodes, all at once. Unlock your listening now by clicking subscribe at the top of the Cover Up show page on Apple Podcasts or visit getthebinge.com to get access wherever you get your podcasts. Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat, is hosted by me, Josh Dean. The series was created and produced by Ben Robbins. It was written by Rajiv Gola. Our senior producer is Emil Klein. Additional production by Abhikar Adan and Natalia Winkleman. Emily Martinez is our story editor and executive producer. Our theme song was created by Ira Wolf Tootin. Sound design by Ewan Leitremuen and Bart Warshaw, with support from Emil Klein. The series was fact-checked by Jordan Reed and Callie Hitchcock. Special thanks to David Shin and Sue Zizza at Radio Wave Studios. And also to our operations team, Doug Slaywin, Ashley Warren, and Destiny Dingle. Campside's executive producers are me, Josh Dean, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Adam Hoff, and Matt Scher. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps other listeners find the show. And maybe recommend it to a friend while you're at it. Thanks for listening. See you next time.